Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. Minor glitch today. We seem to have misplaced my beginning music. Well, we will dispense with the music at least to begin the program and get right to my guest, which is really what it's all about. And I'm delighted to have Robert Abele back. Bob is a professor of humanities and philosophy at Diablo Valley College in California. If my count is right, he's written four books. They include Democracy Gone, Anatomy of a Deception. That's about the Iraq invasion in 2003, the occupation, and preparation for the next deception. And boy, they just never stop coming. You know, Iraq, then Libya, the Afghan one continues, the plans targeting Syria and Iran, and you can bet you there are more in the queue that we haven't heard about. I know Sudan is on the list, Somalia is raging, that's a proxy war, but don't discount the Marines going in. Well, they've been there before under George Bush Sr. a couple of decades ago, and there were some nasty incidents. Since then, the Somalis do not like to be occupied, and they've been waging a liberating war for years. And the fact that they haven't quit means they won't quit, and the Afghans won't quit. And don't think the Iraqis are quiescent or the Libyans. These people don't like occupying powers. It's their country. It's their land. It's their rights. They want to live free, and they have a right to, and they're supported by international law. Bob, I could keep this up for the whole program, but welcome.
Thank you, Steve. And congratulations on all the articles you're putting out with all of the things you were just talking about. If you keep writing like that, you're going to have yourself on as your own guest and interview yourself as you go. You're putting a lot of material out there.
I do have other hosts invite me on, and when they do, I am very delighted to come on. The only times I can't is if their program conflicts with mine, and that happens once in a while. Not too often, but occasionally.
Well, that's great. They should put you on tape delay then.
Well, some of them do tape in advance. A PRN can tape. I prefer to go live, and the only times I ever take are I believe three times a year when PRN shuts down for holiday weekend, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And last year, I pre-recorded my programs during the week ahead of the holiday break. I think most hosts run repeat programs. And as long as I can, I prefer fresh ones. So you've got archives on the old ones, which are there, and you've got new ones, and even though they're airing taped on the holiday weekend, they very much represent fresh programs. And I'm sure that I want to do it again as we get to the end of the year holiday season, but we're a long ways from that. Oh, Bob, there's so much going on. I'm just literally chilled by the extent of U.S. war crimes and the people I call major media scoundrels that not only cover them up, but they cheerlead them, literally cheerleading the wars. I drafted an article this morning, my second one, on the latest Afghan massacre, the 16 civilians that were massacred by U.S. Special Forces. They were death squads, and the official story is that a lone sergeant was the gunman, and they're even making excuses about him, Bob, that he was stressed and on his fourth deployment and wounded in two previous ones, and it goes on and on and on and on. I mean, the guy was trained to be a killer. That's what special forces are. But he wasn't alone. There was an investigation on the ground for 2 days in Afghanistan, and the committee, the Afghan committee that did it, based on eyewitness accounts, said anywhere from 15 to 20 U.S. soldiers were involved in this massacre. So the cover-up is in, and the media are part of it, Bob.
They are, and it's a cover-up across the board. I mean, you can start with Afghanistan and what some people are referring to now as the U.S.'s new version of My Lai and the My Lai massacre. I don't know if that lines up, but it's certainly the case that you had the same thing going on in South Vietnam, where you had a puppet regime, just like you do in Kabul, and you have a great influx of American troops and dollars, just like you had in South Vietnam, that kind of led up to all of that. In addition to that, the fratricide issue, the leading cause of death among occupation forces right now, it was the same in Vietnam. So we may be seeing our My Lai moment as a result of this. And that's what some journalists are talking about. I'm not sure how far I would go with that, but it certainly fits.
Well, I think you're referring to My Lai. I may be wrong, but I've seen that in a couple of major media articles. I've seen that, and I think they want to portray it not as a repeated type of offense, but as an outrageous, a very rare event. My Lai, I think hundreds of Vietnamese were murdered by U.S. soldiers, and it was only because U.S. soldiers, I believe from a helicopter, spotted it and came down and just raised holy hell about it, and they ended up reporting it. But there was a man by the name of Colin Powell in Vietnam at the time, and it was Major Colin Powell, and initially he was part of the cover-up.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. What I was referring to was the conditions on the ground that led up to My Lai, which we see the same going on in Afghanistan.
Oh,
right,
yeah.
Even though in terms of the numbers killed, there's nowhere even close. There were something like 300 or 400 killed in the My Lai massacre and only 15 here. It's the conditions that I'm pointing to that lead to that, where then there becomes an upsurge of people saying, now it's time for you to go. And so we move in that direction. So, and you see the same thing with Obama saying, well, we're gonna get out of there. We'll get out of there. But in the meantime, you have SOCOM, the Special Operations Command in the U.S. military, that are asking for, and from what I'm gathering, they're getting more and more autonomy and power to dispatch killer elite squads anywhere they want to put them without the authorization of Congress or the Obama administration. So the shift that would occur, it seems to me, in Afghanistan as well as elsewhere, is to just give the Special Operations Forces the power to expand their presence without any accountability, using whatever means they want to assassinate and kill whoever they want. So I think the whole point of this is that we're going to see a little tilt in what we're doing in the war. It's not going to be so much overt anymore as if you get the Special Operations Command just doing what they want to do, followed by Obama's drone war. And I think what they're doing is they're sowing seeds for clandestine warfare, not just in Afghanistan, but in Asia, Africa, and now particularly they're targeting Latin America. So I think we're going to see a shift in what we're doing with our wars.
Oh, indeed so. And another big area, Bob, is East Asia, mainly China. China is a major target, just the way Russia is. Both countries know it. But in a speech that Obama gave weeks back, he talked about emphasizing a building up U.S. Military presence in two regions of the world. One was the Middle East, of course, and the idea, you know, all the headlines about U.S. Combat troops out of Iraq, what a bunch of baloney. There were still about 50,000 there. And any U.S. troop, even a cook, is a combat troop. They're all trained. They all can fire weapons. They'll all use them if ordered to do it. They're all combat troops, and they're still there on super bases, and there's no intention of leaving. And the military force has been built up in the Middle East over the past few months. The ones that have come out of Iraq have been repositioned nearby or sent to Afghanistan or sent surrounding Syria. I mean the abuses go on and on. And the other area was East Asia, South China Sea. America wants more troops in Australia. There's a big dispute in South Korea on Jeju Island. This has been going on for many months. The Navy wants a new base to deploy nuclear-powered ships with Aegis radar and all kinds of stuff, targeting China, of course. And China is furious about this. And the residents of this island, which it was a marvelous place without the military there, I mean, they have been enraged and protesting, including people going on hunger strikes when they were arrested. It's their home. It's their island. They don't want the U.S. military there. But the South Korean government gave the Navy the right to build this base. And there are terrible things going on there. I haven't followed it on a regular basis. But months back, I wrote one article on it.
Well, that, you know, when I hear you talking like that, one of the first things I think about is, well, two things, actually. Number one, I think we need to start looking at that term that nobody wants to talk about, fascism in the USA. And part of the drive for fascism comes when you're attempting to maintain a world empire. You can't maintain a world empire around the globe and not have fascism at home. I mean, it's a direct connection. And the way that it is often done is through exactly what we're talking about here, the use of kind of low-level warfare engaged here and there and trying to inhibit other countries from growing and developing. That's how you maintain empire, both at home and abroad. And that's fascism. And the second thing that comes to mind here is that one of the things that seems to be off the table in the news media and in discussion is Latin America. I mean, Latin America now has China particularly and India as a second trading partner. U.S. is now third in Latin America in terms of securing an economic relationship. So the U.S. power in Latin America is declining because they're going to Southeast Asia to get their goods now, India and China in particular. So what's happening now is because they're able to have that trade with China and India, now Latin America is in a position where they're looking at the U.S. and they're saying, wait a minute, we don't like your bases here, particularly in Colombia. There's this big push coming up now. You've got seven military bases here. SOCOM wants even more bases. We don't think we want that anymore. So in late April, there's a conference in Colombia. I think it's called the National Patriotic Council. I think that's right, NPC, in which they're going to meet to start pulling together their movement to push the United States back. They're getting the economic and the trading base that they can say, well, we don't need you anymore. Get out of here. So this is all interwoven here. You've got an attempt to maintain empire abroad. It comes back to visit us at home with the reduction of human rights, and it involves all these other countries that are strung together in this world economy that you can't just stop one place. And I think Obama knows that. You can't stop in the Mideast. You got to go to China and contain them. And then you can't stop with China because they're trading with Latin America, so you got to contain them. And ultimately, I think it's going to be a recipe for disaster. It's going to be catastrophe for the United States economy. We cannot maintain that kind of empire without taking everything else away at home. And they seem to be willing to do that and are doing that pretty readily. I mean, H.R. 347, that now they're trying to suppress dissent, and the FBI spy apps that they're trying to put on phones and things. Suppress dissent, take the money from low economic levels, and keep the empire going.
Boy,
that's a lot of stuff. That's a lot of stuff that we're doing all at once.
It's a lot of stuff, Bob, and the abuses never end, and all the abuses at home, as you mentioned, I write often on that. I cover the hot spots of the world, and one of the hot spots is what's going on right here, and I mean, just the Occupy Wall Street folks as well. In hundreds of cities around the country, the local cops colluding with Homeland Security, federal authorities, brutalizing these people. So in other words, people who have come out and are sick and tired of the abuses that are coming down on them for so long, and of course they're really extreme when it affects people in the pocketbook, people don't pay so much attention. They should. But they don't pay so much attention to the imperial wars. You know, there aren't bombs going off in their neighborhood. But when they lose their jobs and their homes, or they see their neighbors have had it happen to them, and they fear that they can walk into the office the next day and there'll be a pink slip saying they don't have a job anymore. When you're living under this, and the administration and a bipartisan agreement in Congress says, we need shared austerity, which is Obama's phrase, shared austerity. Shared austerity means ordinary people, shared sacrifice. Translated, it means ordinary people have to sacrifice so super rich elites can share. And that's the way the system is going. Absolutely unprecedented, out of control. So you see billions of dollars being made, dare I say, stolen. My new article today, Bob, one of them, on Goldman Sachs, is called Goldman Sachs, colon, making money by stealing it. And my Wall Street book, How Wall Street Fleeces America, had a very detailed article in it on Goldman, including its history, its principles, going back to the beginning. If I remember all of them, I know I went back a good number of years. I mean, this isn't a bank. Even before it became an investment, well, it was an investment bank. Then they changed in 2008 to a bank because investment banks can't borrow at the Fed window, and banks can. And now they borrow practically interest-free. But Goldman, throughout its history, has been involved in virtually every major financial scandal, an awful lot in the 1920s leading up to the crash. I mean, they fleeced people back then. But, you know, they got bigger and stronger over the years, so the abuses got much, much bigger. And then in more recent years, they got their people into key positions in Washington. I mean, financially, they don't get any bigger than the Federal Reserve, or if not their man, somebody associated with them, like Greenspan and Bernanke, not Goldman alums, but close enough, honorary Goldman alums. But you had Hank Paulson, Treasury Secretary. You had Robert Rubin, Treasury Secretary. This goes on and on. A guy named Friedman, another Goldman CEO. There's a whole string of them, and they've had top jobs in Washington. They've rigged the system so they can steal with impunity, and once in a great while, they get caught. So, you know, they steal tens of billions of dollars, and they get fined a few hundred million. That happened a few years ago. The SEC hit them with a $500 million fine. It was pocket change. And in my book, I said, and I repeated it in my article today, that fine amounted to 4 2009 trading days revenue, Bob. In other words, they didn't even notice it.
Well, just like the crowing that Obama did with the U.S. Justice Department having the mortgage settlement with the nation's five largest banks less than a month ago. It was a $25 billion settlement, and the banks have to pay only $5 billion of that. The rest of it comes out of taxpayer funds. And it really just helps the banks balance the mortgages that are on their own books. It just gives the banks all the relief they want while taking it off the backs of everybody else. In the meantime, you have study after study coming out talking about the collapse of the middle class, the rising poverty in America. I just read a Pew study last month, Pew Research Center, that they have a study called Rising Share of Americans Falling into Poverty or something. And it shows that the issue of class conflict has resulted in lasting damage to individuals, families, and communities, while the people at the very top have continued to prosper. And then you got Obama coming along and producing his new budget, which has $1 trillion over 10 years cuts to domestic spending, while really, in effect, raising the levels of the Pentagon spending, even though he has said otherwise. And the biggest cuts that he's put in his budget, $360 billion over 10 years that go to Medicare and Medicaid through reducing payments to health care providers. So, and then you got other pension cuts and other things going on as opposed to that rhetoric. So that all plays into what you're saying, that there's a very rapid movement toward complete control at the top, at the 1%, as the Wall Street people call it, the Occupy Wall Street people call it. And it's happening faster than we can keep up with it. So I think what the Occupy, going back to what you started with the Occupy people, what they need to do if they're going to keep their movement alive is not just protest and say we're mad, but you've got to protest in a particular way by pointing out specific things with solutions involved. So you're going to have to talk about the problem of defining property. You know, I heard Mitt Romney talk about this a couple of weeks ago, maybe last week, where he started talking about private property as the basis of all freedom. Well, that's a real problem if you look at that, because it's not private property that is the basis of freedom. It's rather what people who have money are able to do with that money that's the basis of their freedom to own. And so what we need to do is kind of redefine this notion of property as what it is, and take that away from the wealthy, that grab on the idea that this is freedom, private property is freedom, my money is my freedom, and say the only reason that you can say that is because you've been able to exploit other classes to do that. And let's go back to this notion that the freedom of the individual is connected with the notion of the common good. And unless the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street protests do something like that at the start and go after this notion of individualism, there's nothing that's going to happen from this. And from the way you were just talking, I don't see that happening.
No, I don't see it happening yet. You know, we've been through the winter, Bob, and the Occupy Wall Street protests have ebbed a little bit. It's not as easy to come out in colder weather as it is in warmer weather. The winter, though, has been extraordinarily mild, even before the absolutely unbelievable weather we've been having for a good number of days. I know in Chicago, we literally, for about the last 10 days, have had late spring, early summer in March, which is absolutely unheard of. We've had a string of 70-degree-plus days Fahrenheit, and one day it nearly hit 80 degrees. The five-day forecast calls for 70-degree-plus going ahead. I mean, I can't believe this is March. Well, as far as weather goes, there's no weather excuse holding protesters from coming on out. And if it's this mild in Chicago, I'm sure it's mild in the east. I think it is. Uh-huh. And the further south you go, the more mild it gets. So weather is not an obstacle. And what the movement needs is to get a lot more people joining it, realizing that the people who call ourselves our leaders, our government, they are complicit with Wall Street and other corporate crooks. They're stealing us blind. They're robbing our futures. They're using the nation's resources for things benefiting actually a fraction of the top 1%. And, you know, another 5 or 10% get some benefits. And you get much below that, and people are really being hammered. There'll be massive home foreclosures to come. The deprivation levels are extreme. The real unemployment rate approaches about 23%. And I follow the work that economist David Rosenberg does. He's one of the few honest ones who came out of the mainstream. Now he does his work up in Canada for a small firm. But based on data that I saw it, and I can go back and cite it if I want to use it in an article, but he cited data that tells him while the official number of U.S. people unemployed is something on the order of 10 million, his analysis of this data, which is solid data, tells him that 30 million Americans who want to work can't find a job. And the ones who do find jobs, they're rotten jobs. They're temporary. They're part-time. They're with few or no benefits. And as Paul Craig Roberts writes in his articles, one of his most recent ones, America is becoming a third-world nation. Absolutely. America is. I mean, India and China and other countries are rising, South Africa even, Russia. These countries are rising. America is sinking, and it's because of corrupt policies of the people in Washington, and the Democrats, just like Republicans, makes no difference. It simply doesn't matter whether we elect Republicans or we elect Democrats. They're interchangeable. The differences are minor. On major issues, Bob, there's not a dime's worth of difference between them. I'm talking about war and peace, corporate favoritism, police state laws. You know, there'll be differences on gay rights, stem cell research. I mean, they are not unimportant, but they don't rise to the level of the big things where the great majority of people in the country suffer, where America's resources go for imperial wars, killing people, where the Congress enacts huge austerity cuts. And by the way, Bob, after the November elections, an agreement has been reached. We'll see the way it's employed. But an agreement has been reached by the so-called super committee that convened before last November. Then it disbanded. And the agreement was that after the elections in November, there will be at least $4 trillion in budget cuts. Now, some is supposed to come from the military. But don't believe, the only military cuts, Bob, will be out of the hides of servicemen, you know, paying more for their health care benefits. I can't imagine cutting their pay. You send them to get their heads blown off and you cut their pay. I can't imagine that would be a rebellion in the ranks. But, you know, when they retire and they get out of the service, well, their health care for wounds won't be as good. Their pension rights won't be as good. Those will be the cuts in military budget. But nothing will come out of the hide of the Pentagon. The military budget automatically goes up every year.
Actually, if you look at the way Obama's statistics break down on his budget, as I was getting at a moment ago, he actually does raise the level of money that goes into the Pentagon. It just reapportions it. So that it's kind of a smoke and mirrors thing. It reapportions it, and it actually raises it over the next 10 years rather than lowers it. That's the direction he's going. And his response to the problem you're talking about of lowering wages and benefits, his response just 2 weeks ago was to say, well, we need to lower the tax rate for corporations from 35% to 28%, and that's really going to help, and down to 25% if you manufacture in the United States. That's not going to help anybody but the upper 1% again. So, and you mentioned something about climate change, and I want to, going back to what you started with, there was a study that just came out this past week. It was produced in the journal Science, and there were 21 scientists from the United States and Europe who said that we are now entering unknown territory in Earth history regarding ecosystem change. And the big problem is the burning of CO2s, the putting of CO2s into the atmosphere, which is raising the acidity level of the oceans, which is beginning to wipe out the lower life forms in the ocean. So the ocean is being converted now into carbonic acid. And when that happens, you really start to see huge problems that occur in the environment. So what does Bill Gates and David Koch and all of these top wealthy individual group do? They say, why don't we just geoengineer the atmosphere to try to make some changes so that we don't have to stop what we're doing, and maybe we can compensate for climate change. And then on the other side, you've got the David Koch machine funding all these organizations and writers to deny what these scientists have said. Across the board, where there's absolutely no contesting in the scientific community worth talking about regarding what we're doing to the planet. But yet you've got the rich saying, no, we're not doing that, and we'll fund all the people and organizations that want to deny that. And then Gates saying, well, let's put some money into geoengineering too so that we can basically avoid the problem. So now we're back to, what are we going to do to change it? And if you've been keeping up with what they've done in Iceland, I think Iceland has a really nice way of attacking this issue. They just went back to their assembly and they decided that they were going to agree upon a set of collective values and a vision for the future. And lo and behold, they come up with the idea of the need to increase public services, be environmentally responsible in their policies and economies, ensure transparency in the government for the future. That's what we need to be looking for. The other countries are going to teach us what direct democracy is all about, getting away from the corporations, stop invading other countries, making corporations servants of the people rather than controllers of the people. That's the kind of democracy that is worth changing for.
Well, it sure is, Bob.
Besides, oh, your music is back.
Oh, well, I think a great deal about it, and I also think about all the other pollutants that absolutely desecrate planet Earth. We want to take a break, and we'll come right back. But I mean, just the polluted water, the contaminated food. It goes on and on and on. Let's break, and we'll come right back. Welcome back, talking with Bob Abele. So many abuses, Bob. We've spent a lot of time at home. Maybe we can spend a little bit more time abroad now.
Sure.
It obsesses me so much. The reason I do so much writing is because I'm aware of all these things going on. I follow the right sources of information to pick up on what's most relevant at this time, current stuff that really demands attention. There's a lot, and I try to focus on what strikes me the most. Sometimes it's too much, so I just have to pick and choose. But I'm only one person with no helpers. I still manage to do quite a bit, but if I had a team working with me, I'd get out an awful lot more. But it's important to do. Most people don't know it. I have an article written I haven't gotten out yet because it's not time sensitive, but I berate the majority of people in the U.S. for their ignorance. I almost called it sublime ignorance. I think there may be a line in it or in one of my other articles where I said that ignorance isn't bliss, it's dangerous. You know, people don't realize that they're being hammered, that their own rights are being destroyed, their futures are being destroyed. Their kids are going to have it worse than they have, and they have it pretty bad. And it's because of the policies of the people running the country. They're criminals. We have a corrupt system. We have a dysfunctional, broken electoral system. We have corporate crooks connected with the political crooks. And they're just beating up on ordinary people to benefit the elite few in the country, and the extreme levels just keep getting worse and worse and worse, and most people are just oblivious to this stuff. They get themselves focused on the non-essentials, you know, the bread and circus stuff that absolutely has no meaning in their lives, and they simply don't care enough. They're indifferent to the horrors going on around them, and I feel like I'm living in a war zone of sorts. And I literally have to duck for cover writing about this stuff, wondering, things are so bad. Things are so bad, Bob, literally, anybody can be targeted. How many people, listeners to this program know, but how many ordinary people know that Obama declared open season on U.S. citizens? They can be killed. Even people who know it think it's only abroad. It's not only abroad. It can be right here in America. They can be seized at their homes. Their doors can be broken in the middle of the night. They can be hauled away. They can be thrown in a military dungeon. They can be left there uncharged. They may get a trial, which would be a military trial, with no right of appeal. They could be sentenced to death. What do? There could be no charges. Well, if there are no charges, there probably won't be a trial. You'll just rot in that military dungeon as long as they want to keep you there. Not only people outside the country, but U.S. citizens, wherever they are in the world, including at home. And, you know, some of us are more obvious targets than others. People like you and I, Bob, who do the kind of things we do and speak openly. But if we don't do it, who will? Who can stop this stuff?
I agree 100% with what you're saying, Steve. And I'm thinking about the people that I have spoken to generally about this, and there is a great degree of ignorance out there about what's going on. And by that, I simply mean lack of knowledge about what's going on. Except, interestingly enough, when I talk to my classes about this, and you would expect to a certain extent that young students in a college level, not all of them are going to be politically savvy or have the information that they need. But it's large measure when I'm talking about the unconstitutionality of Obama's targeted assassinations of U.S. citizens and Eric Holder's defense of that he did a couple of weeks ago. I'm in large measure met by blank stares. But interestingly enough, the people who do want to say something are the people in my class who belong to the Tea Party. And the Tea Party people have an intuitive sense of what's going on, and they don't like to be told that these things are all wrong. So you end up with some pretty vibrant debates, but I'm learning about where the Tea Party comes from, and it's basically nowhere. They pick up a little fact here and a little fact there, but at least they're picking up a few facts. But they don't have it all together. They're coming from a very different place. But back to the targeted assassinations thing, I'm sure that you found it as appalling as I did that Eric Holder, our own attorney general, gives a speech saying you don't get judicial guarantees for judicial process in the Constitution. You wonder whether this guy has even read the Constitution. I mean, the right to a speedy trial, the right to an impartial jury, the right to an attorney, the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment, that's not judicial process. Where's this guy coming from? This is absolute power that they're after. And I'm not sure whether to pin Obama for this or just to pin the system that he happens to be tending to, whether somebody like John Perkins walked into his office the first day he was in the Oval Office and put the bullet on his desk and said, either you do what we tell you to do or here's what's going to what end you're going to meet. I don't know where that's coming from, but I would never have expected that even a person like Obama, who I never trusted, even during his 2008 campaign, I never would have expected that he would go this route, in this direction, to say I can assassinate anybody anywhere, and my attorney general says so, and he even says that you don't have any constitutional rights to stop me from doing this. That's dictatorship, and nobody seems to be saying much about it except you or me. So you keep speaking, Steve. You never know. You could end up disappearing. You know, you might not have a program someday. But this is what we're involved with now, and we've got to start ringing the bell louder and louder. But at the same time that we're trying to ring the bell, Obama and corporate America are stripping education. So it becomes harder and harder to educate people when the funds are dropping off more and more for education. And not only are they dropping off for education, but they're shifting the whole focus of education into remedial courses that community colleges in the Obama plan are going to be strictly remedial courses to get people ready to work for corporations. Obama has said it. He's insinuated it. Bill Gates has come out and said it. And even those who watch what's going on in education say, look what Obama's doing. At the same time he's consolidating power and keeping it quiet, he's shifting education from talking about substantive issues to learn how to read, learn how to write, learn how to do some basic math so that when you graduate, you can go to work for a corporation. So I think those two work in tandem.
Boy, they sure do. And as far as remedial stuff, Bob, that goes for the people who maybe will take some kind of a job where they cannot be illiterate. But for so many of the inner city kids in cities like Chicago or Oakland, the area near where you are, San Francisco, across the bay, the kids in the inner city schools, the dropout rates are horrific. Chicago dropout rates a few years ago were as high as 50%. I don't know what they are now, but I don't think anybody cares about these kids. We're talking about poor black and Latino kids mainly. Nobody cares about them. You know, the only thing they're needed for is, if they can even find a job, is something where no training is needed. You know, to punch a cash register or grill hamburgers or work at Walmart's. You don't need a high school diploma to do those kinds of things. I don't think you need a grammar school degree. I don't think they give degrees. You don't need a grammar school education to do those kind of things. So I educate the things. So Bush had his so-called No Child Left Behind. Well, his plan was all children, except the elitist ones, are left behind. And Obama has his Race to the Top. It's been a good while since I've written about either one of them. These are fraudulent programs. And part of the scheme on public school, what we call public school, what I was educated in, and it worked many decades ago, they want to turn it over to corporations to make it to give them another profit center, Bob. Well, whoever right. heard of corporations giving a damn about educating kids? The only thing corporations care about is making a buck and doing it at the lowest cost possible, and they're certainly not going to spend any money to educate kids any more than they absolutely have to, or they'll lose their contract, and of course they won't be asked to do very much. So, you know, the kids who will be treated better, the elitists or the ones in better neighborhoods, they'll be treated a little bit better, even in public schools. But of course, wealthier parents can send their kids to private schools, then they can get anything they want. But inner city kids like I was when I grew up, all the schools I went to in Boston, Bob, in the 1940s, and I finished high school in 1952, all those schools were torn down many years ago, and I went to a grammar school that Leonard Bernstein former conductor of the New York Philharmonic went to. He was about 9 or 10 years my senior, so we never bumped into each other. But we lived maybe less than a mile from each other in the part of Boston I grew up in. I would guess about half a mile. But again, he was an older kid, so we never knew each other. And he went to the same grammar school I did, and the schools were wonderful. They had wonderful teachers. They taught us. There was great classroom decorum. Everything was serious. And it got me into two top schools. That's impossible today. Absolutely impossible. Plus the cost, Bob. I mean, to go to a top school in this country in 1952, my freshman year's tuition, I've mentioned it on this program, was $600 for the whole year. The whole year. And if I lived there with room, board, and miscellaneous expenses, it would have been about double that. It went up before I graduated, but it was still dirt cheap. I didn't need any loans. And, of course, they're predatory loans now. They get these kids debt and trapped for life, many of them. They never get out of debt, and they can never get out from under these loans because they'll take their pay. If it goes all the way to when they retire, they'll take their Social Security from them if there's any left. There's no way to get out of these. You can go bankrupt and walk away from your home mortgage, from your credit card debt. You can never walk away from a student loan. This is grand theft. Outfits like Sallie Mae, a crime syndicate, stealing from kids, debt entrapping them for life. Obama has literally hardened the whole program under the guise of reform. There was no reform in his reform program, just like there was no reform in health care, no reform in financial reform. It's all corporate favoritism and war profiteer favoritism. It goes on and on. And I wrote a couple of times, Bob, that Obama, he never fooled me either. I went back and wrote about his Senate voting record. He sounded as much Republican as any Republican, hardline all the way. I wrote about him that he literally did the impossible for his constituents, his supporters, his ardent supporters. He did the impossible, and most didn't even realize it. He outdid the worst of George Bush. I say categorically, he is, without question, the worst president this him. That's how bad things are in this country.
Yeah, and you know, you go back to when the process started about not being able to get out from under your student loans. That goes back to George Bush the First, who was the one that signed that law that said, no matter what, you still have to pay your student loans. And there was absolutely no discussion about it then. So I think that what corporations did was they took that as a green light to go after education then, and they've got a whole process that they put together, and their method was really easy to see, and you've touched upon some of it in what you were just saying, that first thing you have to do is engage in a lot of propaganda, public propaganda, say that all public schools are failing, large numbers of public school teachers are incompetent, so the only thing that we can do, provide no documentation for that, by the way, no proof, but the only thing we can do is to engage in stripping down the schools, get rid of the unions, and then replace everything that's been going on with test scores. So let teachers teach to the test, and that will preserve their jobs. If they don't teach to the test and their students don't pass the test, then we strip them of their jobs, get rid of them, put someone of our own in there who can't use a union to preserve their job, and we'll start making a lot of money off of that. And that's the way that process has been going. And now we've got that's becoming more and more put into place. Bill Gates, again, behind all of that, a lot of that. He's one of the instigators of that. And so you've got a complete collapse now of public education because it was made to collapse. And that's what I don't think a lot of people who engage in these debates see. It wasn't that the public good in terms of common ground for public collapse, or that liberalism collapsed, or that public education collapsed on its own. It was pushed down, beaten up, and killed. And if all you have to do is look at the public education system to see that process. And then you can go into any other category and look at the same thing going on, whether it's U.S. wars, the United States government consolidating power to itself, all the things that you and I have talked about can be demonstrated to be the opposite methodology and the opposite set of values from what you were raised on, and certainly I was raised on too. I mean, I had the advantage of going to private schools all my life, but the values were still the same, that we live in a democracy, that people count, that people have rights, that equality is a goal that we should fulfill, and that all these things called corporatization and privatization were not even on the map. Because that what they did was they played to the individualism of a few rather than the many. And now we've got it just the other way around. And it's going to take generations to pull this back. And that's why you and I are trying to do to get that push started somehow, along with many other people, too, by the way.
Well, there's no question about it, Bob. And a few years ago, might have been 3 or 4 years ago, I wrote an article, and I think I remember the title. I think I called it, it was a major article, very, very long and detailed, and I think I called it Destroying Public Education in America, and it went chapter and verse talking about the things that you enumerated. That's exactly right. We had a wonderful system going back to the 1940s and 1950s. When I was still in public school, it was a wonderful system. If it worked so well in inner cities, just imagine how well it worked overall. And Boston was no different than New York or Chicago or Cincinnati or wherever. I'm sure the schools worked pretty much the same way in all of these places. Some differences from one city to another, but they worked. And wonderful teachers. I had marvelous teachers, ones I remember to this day. I wish they were still alive. So I actually tried to see if one of my favorite teachers was still living, and I discovered her name, but the Boston educational system had no record of her, whether she had a local address or phone number, and if she did, my goodness, she would have been at least 90 years old, but you never know. She could have been alive. She could have still been vibrant to some degree. And if I had been able to find her, I wanted to call her, wondering if she would even remember me, but I certainly remembered her. But I remembered others the same way. They were just marvelous teachers, even ones I thought were taskmasters at the time. When I look back, I said, they taught. And the kids in their classrooms learned, and nobody caused a commotion. Kids came to school to learn, and they did learn. And if you wanted to go to college, you could go to college, and it was affordable. It was a different world back then, and even post-World War II that I remember so well. I was, 1945, I was 11 years old. So I was old enough to begin understanding things then. We had the GI Bill. Kids came back. The GI Bill was marvelous. It literally created a human infrastructure that grew the prosperity of the country in the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s, and we literally destroyed that and threw it in the trash heap. And now it's gone, and of course there's no GI Bill for the kids coming back from the wars today. They have virtually nothing. Even the benefits they promised, in most cases, the kids don't get it.
You know, an interesting thing with that is if you look around the world at who professional education organizations hold up as the best educational systems in the world. Back in the 1960s, it was England. By the 1970s, it was the United States and into the 1980s. Now, everybody is looking at Finland in the profession because Finland does several things that go exactly to what you're talking about. There are no consequences for tests that are administered. They do administer tests, but they don't fire teachers, get rid of unions, and all that kind of stuff we've been talking about. And they reject these notions of reforms, quote-unquote, like charter schools and standardized testing and vouchers and merit pay for teachers and all that kind of stuff. And the whole idea is that there's the notion of quality and equality in Finnish schools is consistent throughout. And so everybody gets an educational opportunity that they want, exactly what you were talking about. So people like Diane Ravitch now are looking at Finland and saying, hey, you know, this used to be what America had. So, and now everybody's looking at Finland going, what a great school system. Why are they looking at Finland? Because we killed our system. So now it's shipping off elsewhere. And if all we have to do is work to pull it back and start educating again, There was an article on Global Research not terribly long ago, I think it was back in February sometime, asking teachers if they're teaching about U.S. war crimes and destruction of the U.S. Constitution. I thought that was a marvelous article because, particularly for a college teacher, you know, the time to start teaching about these things and being agent provocateur in the classroom is now. You know, what do you think about the Bill of Rights and Obama's attempt to say, well, I don't have to follow that. I can assassinate any citizen anywhere or hold them in detention, do unlimited warrantless searches and all that kind of stuff. And the NDAA and H.R. 347, all these things that go right at the Bill of Rights, and nobody's talking about it. So why not put that back in education and say the whole point is to tell people what's going on, to measure it up against our values, and see whether or not you think that we're going in the right direction. And if we aren't, what are you going to do about it? I think that's part of what education should be.
It sure is, Bob, and people should have more say. People should want to have more say about how their country is run. It's our country, you know, nominally the people who go to Congress, who sit in state houses, city halls, local boards of education, nominally voters put them there. Well, voters are people, they're human beings. In a country that calls itself a democracy, they believe that they have certain rights. The people who represent them should represent those rights, but they don't. It's the reason I believe in direct democracy, Bob. The present system we have simply doesn't work. Instead of representative government, we need a lot more referendum government. Direct democracy. Let people have more say about how their lives will be governed, about what they think should be done, should not be done. We spend our money in taxes. We have a right to have some say over what this money is used for. Just imagine if we really had, just forget the U.S., if we lived somewhere with a real, real direct democracy, there wouldn't be imperial wars. There wouldn't be corporate favoritism. There would be some kind of an equitable system with a level playing field, and everybody had equal rights, no favorites, nobody cheated, nobody getting more than anybody else. Now, I know that's nirvana, and that's pretty hard to achieve, and it's probably impossible to achieve, but just imagine coming to any degree closer than the absolute broken system that we have right now that simply doesn't work, totally broken, totally dysfunctional, totally corrupted, totally illegal the way it's run, and it's for the Constitution, Bob. It was chucked in the trash can a long time ago, before George Bush even, but he chucked it in further. Obama stomped it in, and when you have the highest law enforcement officer in the land, along with Supreme Court justices that go along with this, and of course I'm talking about the Attorney General, and it doesn't matter whether it's an Ashcroft or a Holder, and they literally come down with edicts, or call them what you will, they pay no attention to constitutional law. It simply doesn't exist. It's null and void, and it's up to the people to take back their country. We will not get our country back unless people literally rebel and take it back, and I do believe it's come down to that. I don't believe in violence, but I believe we really need an uprising to take this country back.
Yeah, two things about that. Number one, you sound like a little like Karl Marx, who said that you need to use force of some sort. And he didn't say violence, he said force, or the threat of force, because the only way that the people who are in these positions that you and I have talked about today, the only way they're going to let go of that is if they know that they're going to get dragged out by their hair if they don't. So that kind of threat of force of some sort is going to have to be there at this point. The other side of that is the GOP knows that the only way that people can start to have a voice is if they vote. And so what's the GOP doing? They're targeting swing states for the 2012 election, and they're trying to restrict voter rights with new voter registration laws, which are deliberately targeted against black and Latino voters. And that's been in the news all week this week, on the alternative press anyway. I haven't seen much in the mainstream press about it. But Texas particularly, and South Carolina particularly, it's gotten to the point that Benjamin Jellis, the head of the NAACP, has said that since last year, 15 states have new laws that are suppressing the vote from poor people and students and people of color. And he went to Geneva this week to ask for a delegation of UN experts to come and monitor the United States' voting in 2012 because of all these laws.
Boy, do we need it, Bob. I'm afraid we're out of time. Well, I will go along with Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson said, when a government is not, I don't have his direct words in front of me, but when a government does not represent its people, just the way the revolutionaries, that really were different than our history books tell us, but just the way the people back that had a revolution against the British monarchy, they decided they wanted no more of it, and they rose up and they overthrew it and they installed a new government. And Jefferson said, when government doesn't represent the needs of the people, it's the obligation of the people to get rid of it and install a government that does represent its needs and its rights. And if it was good enough with Jefferson, it's good enough for me. Bob, we got to leave it there. We're out of time. Oh, I wish we had more. We could go on and on with this. But it literally obsesses me every minute of my waking hours. And I'm afraid I think I even dream about it. And I will never stop fighting for what I think is right. They know who I am, Bob. If they want to come get me, I can't hide from them. But if they think I'm going to shut up, they got another thought coming. I'll never shut up. Bob, many thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
And join us tomorrow, of course, same time. Weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern. Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Make it a regular habit.